In the span of just a few short days, our country's transformed in a bunch of ways. To some, it sucks. To others, it's great. But hey, America, you've lost some weight. Welcome, everybody, to Spectrum West, where the arts and culture of Western Wisconsin congregates and converses. I'm Al Ross. Who are you? Oh, I know you. Thanks for being with us. This week, we travel down to Trempealeau County to sit in the backyard of Rick Sampson, banjo picker supreme, joined by Eric Sampson, Rick's very musical offspring. Catherine Thomas welcomes back Jerry Apps to Spectrum West, another book accompanied by another compelling topic of conversation. We'll also meet Stephanie Schneider of Together Farms, a proud operation in the Mondovi area that does things their way, and people love them for it. But before all that, earlier in the week, we heard the announcement that pharmaceutical giant Pfizer had received 90% effectiveness results on its version of a coronavirus vaccine. Uplifting news. Artistic and event venues in West Wisconsin have been doing what they can to survive until the day their doors open to crowds again. We've spoken to Jason Anderson, executive director of Eau Claire's Pablo Center, at different stages of our national predicament. And this week, the news was incentive to reach out again. In a world that's been literally covered with question marks and not much else, the meetings where you discuss protocols for the act of reopening have probably been a little bit uninspiring because the tunnel has remained kind of dark for as far as the eye can see. But after an announcement like the one that came earlier this week about the effectiveness of a Pfizer vaccine, those meetings might become a bit more animated and include some actual implementation. Tell me about the procedures that you've been discussing for the day when the doors reopen.
We've had a plan, and for 8 months, we've continued to modify that plan and adjust to it. But at least within the entertainment industry as a whole across the United States, but more importantly here in Western Wisconsin, we do continue to work with our local and county health departments closely and are really tracking the positive news that you alluded to coming out of the Pfizer vaccine and hoping to see that after mass distribution, that we look to be within kind of that 3-month window after mass distribution of the vaccine across the U.S., which could be as soon as third quarter of next year.
What do you do when you hear something like the Pfizer thing? Do you temper your excitement? What do you do?
I think we do what probably every citizen does at home, and you yourself do, Al. Part of it is read what the news is. What was the study? How many people were active in the study? What are the next steps? And then how does the medical community respond to that news? So much like testing hypothesis, this is exciting. This is game-changing. This could mean that we're opening sooner. But what's the real impact and effect on the community that we're here to serve? You map, track that out, and then see how does that impact your business plan.
Without going into too much detail, because we don't have time, what do the 3 months look like?
Well, as we look at the vaccine, they believe they can make 1.1 billion vials throughout the course of next year. It's really just ensuring that our community is vaccinated. And the idea that once that vaccine has been produced and been distributed, you know, you have at least 28 days between both vaccination courses. You probably have a 3-month window that requires a region to be fully vaccinated at a point that we're safe to open. So we think we lose a quarter of operation from the time the vaccine's readily available to the public to us being safely able to open because we're a last to open industry.
The way it's set up, you will get a green light from the county, the city, medical people?
We will, and we've continued to work with them closely. We've made or are making modifications to the facility itself, installing UVC plasma, which purifies the air here inside the building so that we're not just pulling fresh air into the building any longer. We'll actually be treating the internal air, and we can move back to recirculated air. So we've learned a lot, and we are so ready to get Northwest Wisconsin back into this facility and be producing shows. That's what we're best at.
I had a thought that maybe if the Pfizer vaccine does indeed become the shot in the arm, literally, we've all been looking for, Pablo Center could at the very least give Pfizer maybe a seat in the RCU theater. What do you think?
I'd be happy to give a seat away if that means that I can be open tomorrow.
Just need you to know that we're going to be first in line when the ticket office and the atrium doors reopen. And at the celebration, we're going to be in the front row. Thanks, Jason.
Al, thank you so very much.
So there you have it, a little bit of an update. Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for being here. Fingers are crossed, and masks are still the fashion of the day. Samson and Son do the picking, and we do the grinning, plus Wisconsin author Jerry Apps is back. But first, it's called Together Farms, because they believe together is where we all find ourselves in the challenges of life. The proprietors, Andy and Stephanie Schneider, have principles that don't seem to waver much. They know what they want for themselves, their family, and their livelihood. It needs to work, make sense, and be as wholesome as possible for them and those they serve. Stephanie's a busy woman who took a few minutes to tell me all about it. What's the history of Together Farms? And couple that with the history of Stephanie's involvement in agribusiness.
Well, we purchased the farm, the house barn, 60 acres, to the very end of 2009. And the only reason we bought it is because I was being relocated for my job at the time. And we had to find a property fast. It had 2 weeks. And when you're looking for rural property quickly, you don't typically have a lot of options. And so we had to see what was available and pick one. And all we knew is we wanted to raise our kids in a rural environment and raise a little bit of food just for ourselves. Zero intentions of hosting people on the farm or of selling directly to people or any of that stuff. I have a bachelor's from Northland in natural resources, and then I have a master's from UWGB in environmental science and policy. So, you know, when you have that career bent, education, history, you tend to learn a lot of reasons as to why you should eat healthy and why you should care about the environment, and you learn a lot. And this is what I found at farmers markets, and just from talking to people too, is there usually has to be some kind of catalyst that actually forces you to change your behavior, though, right? So you can know all the whys in the world, but until something like children or cancer or something that scares you or something that really motivates you to change happens, you tend to just, you know, stay in your status quo where it's safe. And so that's what happened with us. So we had kids, and we knew we needed to do a better job of actually feeding them and feeding ourselves. And so we ended up with this farm and then started raising a few pigs for ourselves, gardening. Pigs would get out and eat the garden. So the gardening only lasted a few more years after that frustration. But then, you know, you're doing all the work to water some pigs, to feed some beef cattle. And we thought, well, you know, it's the same amount of work to feed a few more cows, feed a few more pigs, and then we're going to basically get ours for free. Well, right, those are famous last words, right? So here we are, many cattle and many pigs later. And I mean, on the one hand, we were right. It is the same amount of work on the production side of things, but the thing that we hadn't factored into it is, well, now we have created a sales and marketing division that didn't even exist before. So then it was probably about 2012, 2013 when we started selling meat to the general public. And to do that, we just started going to all the little farmers markets, just kind of went wherever we could get in. But of course, we both had our full-time day jobs off the farm. Children would have been 3 and 6 years old. The other thing we didn't factor in, if I'm gone to the farmers market, then that means Andy has two little children, and it's hard to get a lot of fencing done when you have toddlers. So we also didn't do, so things just took so much longer than we ever dreamed. And we did really enjoy going to farmers markets, and we love what we're doing with the meat. Neither one of us came from a farming background, though. We had to learn how to do what we wanted to do here. And we actually did come into it with different ideas. You know, we kind of threw everything at the dartboard to see what would stick. And part of that, too, is seeing what the land wanted to do and what we kind of wanted to do. Where are our strengths? What are we kind of naturally good at? What are our buildings that we currently have or our infrastructure? You know, what does that kind of want to support in the land and our resources? So that's where we've now ended up with 100% grass-fed beef and lamb and then the pasture pork.
You're not defined as organic. What is your operation defined as?
So we used to have the certifications, but just with juggling all the markets and day jobs, it all became too much. And we still aren't really wholesaling very much, so we still know all of our customers or have a direct connection to our customers. So we aren't at the point where we feel the need to have organic certification.
Okay.
But
you are in spirit.
Yes.
Okay.
And we were certified naturally grown for a while, and we do have the cattle certified through the American Grass-Fed Association because there's just so much confusion around grass-fed, and they're probably the best third-party verifier of 100% grass-fed, and that's the thing we most love. And then to help people understand what we're doing here and what our labels mean and, you know, the claims that we make on our website and all that, we do the farm tour every Saturday during the growing season, so people can come out and see what we're doing and see the cattle and hear the story.
You use something called intensive rotational grazing.
Instead of either doing just rotational grazing, where you might have animals out on a pasture for a month or, you know, there's not a lot of organization to it, or where you just have them continuously grazing, which is typically what you see, it's always in that pasture. And so what we're doing with intensive rotational grazing is we're moving them daily to new grass. And what that's doing is that's giving the grass behind them a much longer rest period.
Yeah.
And so the cool thing that I explain to people too on the tour is what you see above ground for vegetation, like with the grasses. So if you see 4 feet of grasses above the ground, that means there's probably about 4 feet of roots under the ground. We'll go back to the same paddock. The paddocks are not set. So that's kind of the art part of intensive grazing, is that you have to kind of eyeball how many animals you have, how many mouths you have to feed, and how the weather has been doing and how quickly your grass is growing to figure out how big of an area to give them. We give them enough so that they all can eat enough, but don't have the opportunity to be picky or choosy about what they eat.
Uh-huh.
So what we're doing is we're forcing them to eat everything. That way, you know, only the non-palatable ones don't go to seed, and you end up with just an entire pasture of, you know,
It reminds me. It reminds me of parents making their kids eat everything on their plate.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Okay.
That's what we're doing. The goal of what we're trying to do is get really good grass growth. So, you know, some beef farmers that do it this way will say, well, I'm not really a beef farmer. I'm really a grass grower. So it's kind of that idea.
Yeah.
So we're using the cattle to manage the pasture growth.
Okay. And you feed your livestock good stuff, not things designed to fatten them up quickly, et cetera. We're on the phone with Stephanie Schneider. She is one of the proprietors, along with her husband and family, of Together Farms, located in the rural Mondovi area. Stephanie, is it harder to do things the way you do, or is it easier and just more natural?
We've never done things the other way, so I'm not sure.
You don't know? Okay.
This way doesn't seem that easy some days. What we're trying to do is work with nature. Ideally, it would be a little easier because we're not trying to force things to happen unnaturally or out of season or out of sync.
Mm.
And we're also trying to get the animals to do all the legwork for us instead of having tractors or machinery or equipment do the work. So,
yeah, sure.
While we have to use our legs a little bit to build new paddocks for them every day, they are harvesting the grass and they're feeding themselves. And, yeah, and we don't really have any health issues. We have learned to push our calving season back a little bit, again, to try to work with nature. One way you can look at it is, you know, how does nature do this? And so if you look at when deer are having their babies, right, so like the wild ruminants, we're trying to sync up our calving to match that more closely. So then we have better grass growing. We don't have to worry about freezing rain as much or the weather problems in early spring. So those were some big problems we had early on that we've, you know, looked at. Okay, well, this isn't working very well for our situation, so now let's adjust and adapt and figure it out. And I don't want to have calves in my bathroom anymore. I mean, people love feeding bottle babies at burger night, but I don't love having bottle babies.
Yeah. Well, your livestock eats very well. I mean, we don't have to get into particulars, but people can learn all that stuff on your website. The barrier that some people balk at is the cost of good food versus what you find in those long meat coolers at the big box stores. We use the term all the time, you get what you pay for, when we're talking about other things like furniture and electronics, but we don't always equate it with stuff that we put in our mouths at dinner time, do we?
No, we don't. And that's because a lot of the costs are being paid in other indirect ways. You know, so we have a lot of subsidies that go into commodity meat. The other impacts, you know, like there might be environmental impacts that the consumer doesn't have to pay directly, but might have to pay through taxes. Or we have health costs, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people will say it's easier for me to pay the farmer now than to pay the doctor later. So there are external costs that we are not passing along in direct ways. The other thing that we do, and really our goal is not to be organic in the way that a lot of people think of organic, but what we are trying to do is we are trying to create a nutrient-dense meat. While it might look the same to our eyes,
mm-hmm.
our body is actually going to treat it as a very different thing.
That's a question I was going to bring up. I mean, the product that you sell is designed to be better for the people buying it, not just a feel-good thing.
Yes.
Healthier.
Right. Yep. So it's going to be better for you because it's got the right balance of omega-3s and 6s. Grass-fed beef is usually 2-to-1, but conventional meats are going to be 20 to even 60-to-1, which means that your body is basically going to kind of treat it not as a health food, not as nourishment, but almost as a problem that has to be dealt with.
Uh-huh.
So there's things in meats that don't have to be listed on the label, all the food stuff, right? Your food is what your food eats. That animal might be eating GMOs, you know, the herbicides, the pesticides, all those things.
Yeah.
And those things don't have to go on the label. Then there are the things that do go on the label, the other ingredients that get added to make sausages or to smoke meats or
mm-hmm.
cure meats or all these different things. So we actually go to a butcher that's several hours away from the farm, mostly, because you know we don't want to spend all this time raising the world's best meat and then end up adding MSG to it. Plus, we don't have to. You know, what you asked earlier about how did it get different?
Mm-hmm.
And part of it is once we start raising animals to grow as fast as possible, we lose flavor, we lose marbling, we lose out on the taste aspect of the food, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So then we have to bring in artificial flavorings. We have to trick our brains into thinking it tastes like what we think meat should taste like. We don't have to add a lot of those things. And of course, we also don't have pallets of meat sitting in warehouses or sitting on semis, right? Like,
sure,
we don't have to have huge, long shelf lives. So we also don't need to have all the preservatives. The other thing I would quickly add to that, too, is I do have people tell me all the time they don't have to eat as much. You know, the United States is one of those few countries where you can be obese and malnourished at the same time because our food is so devoid of nutrients. And we're really trying to make something that's nutrient-dense. And your body, it's going to trigger, hey, you can stop eating. Like, I'm happy now. I have nutrients, and I feel full. That's another cool part.
That's Stephanie Schneider, and our topic has been Together Farms. They raise beef, pork, lamb. They make soaps and candles, too. Lots of things going on. You can shop online. They have events. She brought up Burger Night as one of them. They have a blog. What is your website, Stephanie?
It's real easy. It's just togetherfarms.com.
Even I can remember that. Thanks for being with us on WPR.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
Coming up, we'll enjoy a November afternoon, marvelous for two reasons. It was warm enough to sit outside, and the musical Samsons, Rick and Eric, got together. Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio, and support for WPR comes from Charter Bank, dedicated to investing in partnerships and offering Charter Bank business services with small business loans, treasury management services, and a variety of checking accounts. Details are at charterbank.bank. Well, it wasn't that long, maybe a month and a half ago, we had Jerry Apps as a guest to discuss one of his books. We should say one of his many books. Well, Catherine Thomas is here, and she brought Jerry along to talk about yet another, When the White Pine Was King, his latest. All well and good, because He's a Wisconsin treasure. Here's their conversation.
You have written so many books, it seems like there's always a new one with your name on it coming out. And I was curious how you write so many books. And do you know how many you've written?
The reason I can't tell you exactly is that some of my books have gone out of print, and then I've got another publisher to publish them with a new edition, and I don't know if that counts. Some of the books have international publishers, and I don't know if that counts, so I've given up. It's somewhere around 40, maybe 45, I don't know.
Oh, my. Do you have any favorites?
The most recent one is always my favorite.
Good answer. Yeah. Yes, and When the White Pine Was King is one of those most recent. It was published this year by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. So let's get the full title. When the White Pine Was King, A History of Lumberjacks, Log Drives, and Sawdust Cities in Wisconsin. You have a personal connection to trees and logging, I understand.
I do. I run a tree farm in central Wisconsin, a couple of miles from where I grew up in Washera County. And we bought this property in 1966. We've done, what, three loggings, I think, since then. So I am fairly familiar with modern-day logging practices. The historic logging practices were of interest to me, and I knew something of them because as a kid, we heated our house with wood stoves, and so I had some practice on a two-person crosscut saw. There wasn't such a thing as a fancy chainsaw when I was a kid, and I know something about how to use an axe, both of which were very prominent in the history of the logging industry, as you might guess.
It was huge here in western Wisconsin and other parts of the state in the Northwoods. Its history turns out to be older than the actual organization of the state, and I found it interesting in your book you write that before the industry really took off, farmers in the southern part of the state thought of all the trees as being quite a nuisance because they had to clear the land in order to farm.
That's absolutely right. But realize also that the tree species in southern Wisconsin are very different from those in the north. What they were doing there in clearing land was to cut down the oak trees and the maple trees and the walnut trees and whatever else was growing there. There weren't any white pines at all. The white pine was a northern plant species. The great white pine in the north and the northwest, it was kind of ignored by the farmers in the southeast who saw that whole area, and it was Native American land, of course, for many, many years. It's kind of a mystery because they didn't know much about it. And another interesting thing I found in researching this book is that the farmers in southeastern Wisconsin were not adept at, or did they know how to do the logging required in the north and the northwestern part of the state. The early loggers, the logging companies, brought in lumberjacks from Maine and from New Hampshire and Vermont, and even from the eastern Canadian provinces. These were lumberjacks who had experience with cutting white pine and doing river runs and all that sort of thing. That's kind of an interesting wrinkle. The early lumberjacks were not Wisconsin people. When the logging era was ending in the east, it moved to the Middle West. When it ended in the Middle West, it moved further west to Oregon and Washington. It's kind of an interesting progression. The idea of sustainable forestry didn't come along for a long time. And coincidentally, and most interestingly, the early evidence of sustainable forestry happened to occur on the Menominee Indian Reservation. The Menominees knew inherently about sustainability a long time before their neighbors in the neighboring counties in Wisconsin accepted the idea that, yes, you could sustain a forest by replanting and selectively cutting and all the things that the Menominees had practiced from the very beginning. I think that's just a really interesting story.
So do I, as one of the points in your book that stood out to me the most. But why don't we talk about the white pine? What was so special about that tree that made it especially great for the lumber industry and logging?
First off, the white pine in Wisconsin were absolutely magnificent trees. They would be over 100 feet tall and more than 3 feet in diameter. And it was soon discovered that white pine lumber was the premier lumber for building homes and businesses and barns and all the rest of it. And so cities like Chicago and St. Louis and Milwaukee were largely built with white pine lumber. White pine was relatively lightweight. It was easy to work with, and it was in high demand, especially during the Civil War. There was a tremendous demand for white pine lumber. One of the interesting characteristics of the white pine log is it floated. That allowed the lumber companies to float the logs down the river in those famous log drives, lumberjacks riding the logs. The cover of my book has a picture of that. It was the most dangerous job in the world. And there was a sort of romanticism connected to it because these guys were the heroes of the day. Ride a log from someplace in the north down to the Mississippi River. I mean, it was quite the story of the day.
Jerry Apps is the author of many books, including the one we're talking about today, When the White Pine Was King, A History of Lumberjacks, Log Drives, and Sawdust Cities in Wisconsin. You note in your book that of all the logging regions in Wisconsin, the Chippewa region here in western Wisconsin produced the most wealth. And there are a couple recognizable names of the lumber barons from the era that we would recognize, Knapp and Stout.
Knapp and Stout in particular, because they largely created Menominee.
You write in the book, the Menominee started off as a company town?
Exactly. That in itself is just a fascinating part of the whole story because the logging industry, on the positive side, created the majority of all the cities and towns and villages across northern Wisconsin, from Eau Claire to the other end of the state, Wisconsin Rapids. We can talk about Oconto, Stevens Point. We can talk about Minocqua and Rhinelander, Ashland. We can talk about all of those cities grew up and developed as a result of the logging industry. And they employed thousands of people eventually. And the farmers that I'd mentioned earlier who did not understand the logging industry eventually did, in the winter, leave their families behind at the farm and go north to the logging camps. My grandfather, Apps, was a cook in a logging camp. He left his family behind in central Wisconsin. My uncle Fred, he also was a lumberjack, and he went with my grandfather. So we have that little family connection. I wished I'd been smart enough. I was too little to ask questions of my grandfather, but the cook in the lumber camp was king. If he failed to produce those wonderful meals that lumber camps were known for, there was rebellion.
Oh, my.
Another characteristic of the mess hall was that when the lumberjacks were eating, they were not allowed to talk. Everything had to be quiet. The whole idea was to come in and eat and leave. It was not a social event around the dinner table.
There's a good quote in your book about what bunkhouses were like. When you mix the smell of wet socks with the smell of baked beans and chewing tobacco, you have a smell that a lumberjack never forgot.
That's the truth, or anybody else who visited. Realize that for the most part, they did not bathe from November until April. On Sundays, they tended to boil their clothes in a big cauldron outside. Not so much to clean them as to kill the bed bugs, I'm told.
Oh, man. Sounds really romantic to me.
Yeah, really. And they were close to each other, too. A typical logging camp had about 25 lumberjacks. And it was a primitive kind of deal. And they earned about a dollar a day, a lumberjack earned in those days. But, of course, they got their meals and they had a place to sleep.
Technology, at a certain point during the 19th century, limited the season, the lumber season. Winter would be the start of the lumber season. You'd have your timber cruisers go off and check out the woods and the lumberjacks, and then in the spring it would be the log drive. Can you give us a quick walkthrough of the rhythm of the lumber industry at that time?
Sure. All this would be prior to the railroad. When the railroad came, everything changed. And now we're talking about the late 1800s, maybe in a little bit of the early 1900s. But the typical sequence went like this. And it started in generally in November, maybe late October, were a timber cruiser employed by the lumber company. They had their eye on a particular spot of ground, several acres that looked like it may have a possibility for logging, and so the timber cruiser's job was to go in and affirm that. The economic value of the white pine in that given area might be several hundred acres. Once he came back and reported what he saw, and let's say it was positive, then a smaller crew would go into that area. Generally, there was a river. The prime land had a river through it because the river was necessary for the transportation of the logs. They would build the mess hall. They would build the sleeping quarters. They'd build a barn for the oxen or the horses. A couple weeks later, the rest of the crew would come in, and then they would go out into that area, and with a crosscut saw and an axe, they would saw down these magnificent white pine, slice them into logs maybe 16 feet long or so, hitch a team of horses on the end of the log with a device called a go-devil, kind of a pseudo-sled that lifted the front end of the log up enough so that it wouldn't drag in the snow, and they would pull the logs to an assembly area where they were loaded on sleighs. I have pictures in the book that they're 10, 12, 14 feet high logs piled up on these sleighs. And then two, four, six horses would pull this sleigh down to the nearby riverbank where they were piled again in enormous piles, because this would go on from November, December, January, February, March until April. And when the ice would go out, they would dump these logs in the river, and that's what created the log drive. Some of the rivers were not conducive to log drives. The Wisconsin River was an example. Twists and turns and stones and rapids. The Wisconsin River had a lot of early sawmills. Log drive didn't go very far. Mm-hmm. But the Chippewa was better. The Wolf was better as a clear driving river. And so they could drive the logs a longer distance to the sawmills. And the summer months, the sawmills were operating, of course, but nothing was going on in the woods.
Well, the lumber industry did eventually fall into a decline, but it's never gone away altogether.
We have a very good lumber industry, a woodworking industry in Wisconsin now. Many of the cities born as a result of the logging era continue as places where there's a woodworking industry. And the fact that we began to understand sustainable forestry meant the woodworking industry could continue. We need to give credit to the Civilian Conservation Corps that operated until 1941 or two, if I remember correctly. I wrote a book about that as well. They replanted. The idea that once the white pine was cut that it would self-generate was just not true. It didn't happen. Another offshoot of the logging industry is the paper industry. Wisconsin still, to this day, is the leader in the manufacturing of paper pulp in the nation. That segment grew out of the logging industry.
It's called When the White Pine Was King, A History of Lumberjacks, Log Drives, and Sawdust Cities in Wisconsin. The Wisconsin Historical Society Press published this one, and that's where it can be found for those interested. Appreciate your time, Jerry. I sure learned a lot from reading your book.
Sure. And anybody wants further information, just go to jerryapps.com.
Thank you.
Good luck. Stay
yeah.
well.
Bye now.
Thank you, KT. This is Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. Support for WPR comes from Marquardt Toyota, committed to delivering an authentic and enjoyable automotive experience. Marquardt Toyota is located off Highway 53 between Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls, and at MarquardtToyota.com. Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. Rick Sampson is the dad, the banjo player, the experienced, well-traveled musician, and the guy known in wide music circles for handcrafting some of the most sought-after bridges for banjos. And Eric Sampson is the son, in his 20s, responsibly involved in a meaningful vocation and sharing what he knows, but also serendipitous in his passion for making music. I paid a visit to Rick's Trempealeau County homestead, where we sat in the backyard on a breezy and unnaturally warm November Sunday afternoon. First question went to the patriarch. So you're a guy for whom the 70s would have been formative years, but the 70s, when I think about it, was full of rock and roll and disco and some bubblegum music. Folk was still around. when did you find yourself swimming against all those currents I just mentioned and being interested in the banjo?
Well, I mean, I felt like the 70s were pretty hot for the acoustic scene. I mean, that's kind of when David Grisman Quintet kind of popped up with Tony Rice and Grisman and all these really hot pickers. And so, I mean, I found that it was pretty hot at that point. I was finding some really...
Hot for you.
It was hot because, you know, there were groups like Monroe Doctrine.
I was disco, I'm telling you.
You were doing disco. I mean, thank God that I never really got into that, and I'm sorry for you that you wasted those years. In the early 70s, I was at the university in Eau Claire. I mean, those days, you had Paula Stichen running this cabin operation. There was all kinds of acoustic music happening. All these people that went on to be kind of, you know, more famous, you know, the Peter Ostrushkos He was acoustic and fiddle and mandolin. And that's when I started playing music, actually. I moved to Green Bay to transfer there in my third year of college, and that's where I heard the banjo. I mean, I had been playing guitar for 1 year. I hadn't played any instruments at all up until college days. So when I went over to Green Bay, I remember hearing somebody upstairs playing the banjo. I saw banjo being played for the first time, sat around and jammed all the time, and everybody was playing guitar, and so I kind of really liked the idea of doing the banjo, and that's when I bought one. So it would have been in 74.
But how did you learn? Did you take lessons?
Nope, I didn't take lessons. I just woodshed and did things that would help me just kind of practice things over and over. I did a lot of my learning by listening to records and just doing it by ear.
And a lot of people start out their music careers that way, but I mean, you really got hooked. I mean, you play other instruments. It's the banjo that always kind of reels you in.
Well, that's the instrument that I really did most of my woodshedding on, was the banjo. Once I got into it, I spent hours every day. I found that music was kind of a passion. That's when I just kind of got hooked on it. And so I got a job janitoring 4 hours a day in the afternoon, and I would take my banjo to work, little school, grade school, and I would come home and we'd stay up all night and do those things you did in the 70s and kind of just drift off into jamming land and listening to music.
I'm obviously aware of Bela Fleck, of course. We've talked about him. And you and we all have him to thank for keeping the banjo relevant all these years. Who else do we have to thank?
I spent a lot of time listening to Carl Jackson. He worked with the Glenn Campbell Hour. He was one of the hot pickers on the Glenn Campbell Show. Larry McNeely was on that show as well. Okay. And so I learned a lot of their stuff. I mean, there's players like Alan Monday, who's fabulous, and John Hickman. And I mean, there's all kinds of great, great players back then. And now there's just incredible amount of players to be inspired by. But, you know, as far as doing the woodshedding, I spent a lot of time studying Carl Jackson, Larry McNeely. Tony Trischka was an influence. He was sort of, Bela actually took lessons from Tony because he was kind of one of the first people that stepped outside. Tony Trischka, you know, he's got an album, he's got saxophone with his bluegrass ensemble. He got really progressive.
So Fleck wasn't the first guy that went off on a tangent.
No, Fleck was kind of this person that would be in the back pages of the book. So there's this young kid over there that's just pay attention to that guy. So he ended up popping up into the world when this group called Spectrum ended up happening when he was living in Boston. And that's when he kind of got into his first bluegrass that I remember. And then when Newgrass Revival, Courtney Johnson passed away, the banjo player for Newgrass, who was also a great banjo player. Then Bela joined Sam Bush and John Cowan and Pat Flynn and became the Newgrass Revival, which went on for years. And they were just a hot, fabulous, progressive kind of bluegrass.
Eric, what were you thinking as a 17-year-old musician? Because you were getting a lot of accolades. You were getting write-ups in magazines. You said, I don't know whether I'll ever make a living at this. But at the time, it didn't seem to make a difference because you were having a good time in the a cappella group and you went to the world deal and you were still enamored with the idea of making music just for the aesthetics of making music.
Right. It's honestly still something that I think about every once in a while of just, you know, what life would be like to wake up and woodshed for 3 hours a day and then play gigs every once in a while and get more serious about recording. And the difference between now and when I was 17 is that I had the time and space to rearrange to potentially entertain that idea, whereas I work 40-plus hours a week now, and I also teach at technical college in the horticulture department, and so it has very much become not just a hobby, even though I say that. It's a passion.
You don't look at music as something that you have to share and make money from. It probably affects what you do. It makes you a much more comfortable musician and songwriter.
Yeah, there's no striving to fit any sort of mold or try to be hireable for gigs or weddings or anything like that. We play what we play, and if people like it, that's great. And if they don't, you know, we're not necessarily trying to be anything to anyone other than ourselves. We're expressing ourselves through music, and to not have the pressure of a financial driver pushing that in one direction or the other, it's relaxing in a lot of ways.
How has that affected, though, what you write? Are you finding that you're writing about more inward stuff?
I think as we get older, and I say this as a 24-year-old acting like I know more than I do, but that's fine, you know. Comparatively, you know, when I was 17, reflecting on difficult times, whether they be depression or heartbreak, etc., being able to look at it with more of a, I guess, a wider scope and a wider lens. You know, in the grand scope of things, something that hurts is going to fade, and we're all going to get hurt again, but we're also going to love again and experience happiness and joy. That's part of life. So that realization has kind of allowed my songwriting to be much more reflective, optimistic, and dare I say realistic.
The article that I read about you in 2013 quoted the fact that songwriting can get you through tough times. And here we are in times tough with a capital T, and times we didn't expect, and times that are hurting musicians and arts people more than literally anyone. So is songwriting acting as that soother for you today?
Yeah, it definitely is. It's taken a little different shape, finding myself kind of digging into more personal and internalized things that I haven't really had a chance to think about. But I think we're all finding that we have more time to dive into our innards, if you will. And it's interesting with songwriting, I've become much more aware of when I have emotional blockages, and then eventually the dam will fly wide open, if you will, and everything will come out, and it feels a lot better. So still to this day, the songwriting is the cheapest and best therapy that I could ask for.
Why don't you guys play something?
Sure.
What do you want to play? Do an original.
So this is one that I wrote, actually. I just gotten out of a long-term relationship, then COVID hit. This is like ode to 2020 or something, you know? Changing times.
One, two, three, four.
Guess now this is normal, funny how that goes. Some things last forever, but who the hell really knows? We built a home together out of sand instead of stone. Tide came in and did us in, and that's how the story goes. One step forward and three steps back. Tell me what kind of crap is that? The way I'm going might be wrong. In fact, I hope I turn and run the other way instead. And things are getting dicey. People are getting tired. The ones at the top who never punch the clock are the ones who should be fired. And stories are being forgotten, cause those with ones to tell are subject to our freedom. Our opinions are why they fell. One step forward and three steps back. Tell me what kind of track is that? The way we're going might be wrong. In fact, I hope we turn it around the other way instead. It's probably fine, some say, or maybe it's the end. We'll never know if we refuse to show each other any compassion. Step forward and three steps back. Tell me what kind of track is that? The way we're going might be wrong. In fact, I hope we turn and run the other way instead.
We're sitting in the backyard. We are 9 miles south of Arcadia. We're here in a corner of the house. We're outside. Every once in a while, you'll hear the trees rustle and the leaves blow, and it's a beautiful day. So we're with Rick and Eric Sampson here on Spectrum West. I wish there was a blood test for the music gene. Do you feel like you have the music gene? You must.
I think there's something to be said for having natural knacks for things, for sure. But I also think the biggest hurdle that anyone faces when it comes to the arts is just the permission to do them. You know, the permission to do something that in our society seems like a waste of time because you're not directly making a profit. You're not directly creating necessarily a product that you're going to sell. I think a lot of people have a hard time giving themselves permission to do those kinds of things. It makes a difference too to grow up in a house and a home that music is life. You know, it's not a hobby. It's everything. It's all around. I mean, you walk around and there's at least three or four banjos in every room in this house, albums everywhere. And just, you know, it's surrounded by indicators of what is valued and cherished.
And it's not like music was shoved down your throat, but I did read that you did get a little toy banjo when you were young.
And I switched instruments real quick, but
and so Rick, what did you do with him as a budding musician when he started playing and he was in these talent shows? I mean, obviously you were supportive, but was there a part of you who said, I got to make sure he understands the real world, or should I just support with none of that wisdom?
I think I moved into the just support category. It was, as a parent, exciting to see your kid take a interest and develop a passion for something that I obviously did, and to witness the sort of a chip off the old block kind of thing kind of occur on some level. I mean, that's a good thing that you get from parenting.
Tell me about the bridge thing. I did some reading about bridges, and I didn't realize how much of a difference bridges can make in the tone of a banjo. Have you innovated with bridges?
Yeah.
Is that why they're popular?
Absolutely. I went to Red Wing to the luthier school. I started working with woods. A friend of mine who you know, Peter Phippen, he sort of encouraged me to make a flute. That went very well and ended up evolving into me actually building and selling and going to festivals and stuff with those. So I decided on a whim, what if I made a banjo bridge out of a different kind of wood? Well, I'm going to make a walnut banjo bridge, cap it with ebony, and I made one and I put it on my banjo, right, exactly. And so what ended up happening is it just made the tone just a warmer, more sustaining, richer. That was cool. I liked it. At that point in my life, I was traveling around with Tom Neckville, who makes banjos from Minneapolis, and we were doing IBMA, the International Bluegrass, and we were doing Merle Fest and all these big festivals. He was working with Bela, building banjos, and he was working with a woman named Allison Brown. She's sort of the equivalent of Bela Fleck. She did really like them. I mean, I'll make you bridges, Allison, if you just give me a little quote. And so she said, sure. So she gave me this little quote that said, you know, I've used a lot of bridges in my day, and there's no bridge that does more for the tone of my banjo than the Sampson Bridge. So all I had to do was call stores. I build a bridge for Allison Brown. Are you interested? Well, of course. I was looking for something to do with my skill that I learned in Red Wing. So that gave me, you know, another little niche in the music world.
On a business card, you can come across as somebody very important because you can say, bridge builder.
yes, exactly.
I build bridges.
Yeah, that's impressive. You don't really look like you could build a bridge. But
yeah. I think what I've determined from our conversation is that you just love making music, and you love making music on your own terms. For me to ask you a question about what's your future in music, Eric as a young guy and Rick as a guy who's doing it quite a while.
Seasoned,
that's it.
I like that.
Like a cast iron skillet.
Rick, you're a teacher, and you've lost a lot of capital this year, unable to teach.
I miss that. Okay. I definitely miss that.
You're just going to keep doing what you're doing? How about recording? Are you going to record some more stuff?
Yeah, you know, the last time we recorded an album was when I was 17. There's a few songs that are ready to be recorded, and we probably got enough for a couple of CDs at this point.
I mean, get to work.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you guys for having me at Rick's homestead here. It's been fun.
Thanks,
and
Al.
Appreciate you coming down. And
what's going to take us down the road?
Okay. This is one I wrote when I was living in the boathouse community.
You have to barrel pop to keep your house floating.
Explain that process, would you?
Well, you just get in the water and you pop this barrel underneath your house so it floats. So I wrote a tune called Barrel Poppin'. It's an instrumental.
Samson and Son, Bridge Builders.
2, 3, 4.
We're going to let Samson and Son take us all the way home, but I want to dive in here to let you know that next week, River Falls poet Thomas R. Smith's new book on verse will be one of our highlights. Giving a kid a book at Christmas is a great idea. UW Eau Claire Women's Athletics celebrating an anniversary. And more, always more on Spectrum West, as you well know. Thanks to Dean, Kate, Patrick, and you guys. Be sure to visit us at WPR.org to find all the Spectrum West programs very neatly archived. So, hey, keep in touch. Take care of yourself. It's a good time to wear a mask. Yeah, don't go anywhere if you don't have to. Be good to each other. That's what you're doing by wearing a mask. Get it? See you next week, you guys.